Now, are all the traitors present? Let's get started, shall we?
From rags to riches.
I'm so sick of this.
Working like a dog and being treated worse.
Yorkshire to New York.
We're climbers, you and me.
A life dedicated to revenge.
Let's make this an occasion to remember.
A Woman of Substance on Channel 4. Stream now.
Have you ever had a moment where you realize that you cannot go back to who you used to be? Not because you don't want to, but because something in you or something in life has changed. And so today we're talking about what happens next. Today we're joined by Dr. Carter Check. So he's a clinical chaplain, a healthcare ethicist, a professor, and the author of Healing in the Wild. And his work focuses on something most people don't talk about. What happens when a role ends and you don't know who you are without it? So whether there's a career, relationship, or leadership role or a version of yourself you can't return to, today we're going to go in deeper and talk about what happens after that identity. We're talking about identity, moral injury, and how it actually rebuilds your life. Dr. Carter, this is such an important topic and so beautifully timed. I'm so excited. It's good to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa, for having me. And you're right. There's a moment people don't talk about very often. And it's that moment when something ends and then you realize you can't go back.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm not just talking about the role and not to who you were inside that role. I remember a season in my own life where everything shifted at once, relationally, spiritually, internally. And there was a moment where I realized I couldn't go back to who I was before that happened, not because I didn't want to, but because something in me had already changed. And in that moment, I wasn't just dealing with what happened. I was dealing with who I was after it happened. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what most people miss. They think they're grieving an opportunity or a title or a position or a season. But what actually collapses is something deeper. It's the structure that told them who they were. And so the real question is, what do I do next? It's who am I now when the thing that defined me is gone? And I think that's where a lot of people quietly come undone.
Mm-hmm.
So when you can't go back, the real question isn't, what are you going to do next? It's whether you understand what actually broke.
Yeah. So I remember a time when my whole life shifted and I woke up and I literally felt like a different person. And it was incredibly disorienting because suddenly the routine that I had from that past role or identity didn't work anymore. And it felt so disconnected and inauthentic. And it was kind of like, you're being shoved into another world saying, all right, let's start over. Now what? And it'd be a really scary place to be because you're right. You can't go back to that other identity, whether it is a relationship ends or a job or even an awakening of some sort. It just doesn't feel good. It's like you can feel this pull towards something new, even though you don't know what it is.
Yeah. 100%. You know, my story, when I was in Korea in the service and I went through, you know, my experience where, you know, long story short, the army really offered me and my battle buddy up to prosecute us for assault and battery when we had defended ourselves against Korean nationals. And after going through that and making it on the other side, I was still a soldier. I still wore an American uniform. But that betrayal just made me question everything about my service, my identity, my worth. And a major loss that I experienced wasn't just the betrayal. It was I wanted to be a career soldier. And I felt like now that had been taken away from me. And so, you know, at some point there, I realized I just can't go back. I gotta figure out how to move forward.
Yeah. So you talk about this being more than just psychological. And so you use the term moral injury. So what makes this moral and not just emotional?
Yeah. So a moral injury, if we just break it down to the bare roots of it, it's a violation of what's right to you. And it causes a collapse in what you would consider to make you morally healthy. And again, we're not talking about religion. We're talking about morality. It's an alignment of your values, your identity, your beliefs. And that's subjective. It's what's important to you, not what's important to me that I think should be important to you. So when someone experiences a moral injury, they experience a deep violation of what's right to them. And when that happens, the place where you make meaning, I'm going to call it your meaning-making system, right? The place where you make meaning, where you make meaning about life, you make meaning about God if you're of theistic faith, where you make meaning about the future, the place where you imagine something different just gets shattered. And a lot of times when you hear the word grief stricken, that word grief is attached to moral injury because what moral injury is it's a specialized traumatic grief. It's a specialized loss. And it really damages how you see yourself, how you see yourself in the world, how you see your worth. And, when I say, what does it mean when I can't go back? It means that that external door is closed. But more importantly, the internal version of you that existed in that space you were in is no longer accessible. So you can't return to who you were because that version of you was shaped by a structure that no longer exists. And not only my own personal story, but I've sat across enough veterans to recognize a pattern. They leave an environment where identity is clear, the mission is defined. And belonging is, it's built in to the mission, right? And then you step into a world where none of that is reinforced in the same way. And it's not weakness, it's a loss of structure. So when the role ends, like when my role ends, most people think they lost their position, they lost their identity, right? But what they actually lost was the structure that told them who they were. And once that structure is gone, people don't just feel lost, they feel undefined. So what moral injury does is it damages the structure of what makes you morally healthy. And then you feel like that's when that structure is gone, you just feel lost and you feel undefined or incomplete.
Yeah, and a moral injury for me may be different for you. And so that adds
Yes.
another layer. And so something that feels immoral to me may not to someone else. And if you talk about it to someone else, they may not see it like you see it, but you feel the disoriented feeling. And so that can add another layer of confusion because then you're questioning your own view of it. Am I overreacting? Should I just push through this? And you question that, and that makes it so difficult.
And a lot of people, Lisa, they'll argue, well, isn't moral injury, isn't this psychological? No, it's not a psychological wound. It's a wound to your meaning-making system. If you're going to call it a wound to anything, it's a wound to your conscience, your identity. It's a wound to who you are. So it's not psychological. It's not just psychological. It's more than that. At your core, it's moral. And this isn't just emotional pain. It's what happens when something you believed was right no longer holds. And now you don't know where to stand. So people lose more than stability. They lose orientation. What they believed about, what was right, what would hold, who they were in relation to that, that's been disrupted. It really, if I had to, I've been a suicide prevention specialist in the VA for the last 11 years of my professional career. And I would argue this, and I know that you and I have had this conversation before. I think sometimes in medical systems, we're so symptom driven, anxiety, depression, the PTSD. We're so symptom driven, and not that that stuff's not important, it is. But we're so symptom driven, we miss people. Well, when you miss people, that's where moral injury exists. It exists in the person, not the symptom. And so I would argue this. I believe moral injury causes more people to die by suicide than anything we could pull up in the diagnostic systems manual that has a Z code to it that insurance companies pay for, right? I believe that we'll find out in the years to come that moral injury is one of the major drivers to suicidal ideations and actual suicide deaths across the board. And this isn't just a veteran thing. This is a human thing.
You have to look at a person's symptoms, but then look at their life holistically. And so, if you're missing the big pieces, if someone has a life that is not balanced, like if there's not a balance of purpose and health and connection and community, a whole bunch of things, then I feel like there's going to be some dis-ease show up. And when you go see a conventional doctor, and I'm not again, like all of these symptoms are important, but you need to be able to look at your life holistically to see what pieces are missing, and start trying to detach from identities that you think you are. That could be another topic for another day, but man, it often feels like, you're doing everything right, and then all of a sudden, life changes in a moment, and you're like, wake up and you're like, who am I and how do I start over? Do you have any real life examples of people that you work with who've kind of gone through these things, and maybe you can relate something to the audience so maybe they'll understand it a little bit better?
Let me share this, that there's a difference between role loss and identity loss, right? Role loss is external. Identity loss is internal. So you can lose a role and still know who you are. But when identity is tied to performance or responsibility or impact or the loss of that loss of role destabilizes the self. That's when people say, I don't recognize myself anymore. And that's not confusion. That's disorientation at the level of identity. So when you say, give me some examples, I work with a lot of high performers, business leaders, athletes, special operators, first responders, right? And they usually struggle more because their identity was reinforced by clarity. They knew what mattered. They knew their role. They knew where they fit in. And when that disappears, they don't just lose structure. They lose the feedback that told them they mattered. And here's where it gets really complicated, Lisa. You can still perform at a high level and be completely disconnected internally.
You're right.
Competence can outlast coherence. So from the outside, everything looks intact, but internally, something fundamental has shifted. And that is super important to recognize.
Yeah, absolutely. It could be so difficult because people present so well. I think we spoke about this last time, is I know there's been times where I've been barely holding on, where I've been so confused as to where I am in my own life, and I don't feel like anything, I don't fit in anywhere. And internally, I just feel awful. But on the outside, I'm not expressing that. I'm not sharing that with anybody else. And that's the scary thing is like, most of the time we look at another human being and we see them, but we don't see what's happening on the inside, so we assume everything is fine. Why does this happen?
When a role ends under strain, whether that's betrayal or failure or impossible decisions or broken systems, or let's say an event that happened to you, the person doesn't just lose the role. They carry unresolved tension. So I've had conversations with people who did exactly what they were trained to do. Followed the mission, made the call, carried the responsibility, and then walked away asking, why does this feel wrong now? I did what I thought was right. So why did this end the way it did? And the question doesn't resolve on its own. It follows them. It follows you where you go. So remember, when you can't go back, the real question isn't what you're going to do next. It's whether you understand what actually broke.
What are the risks of moving on too quickly or trying to figure out everything super fast?
Oof. I think the risk is not being seen, not being heard, not really understanding the struggle the most, because their framework is it's usually built on trust and how things are supposed to work. So, like this, effort leads to outcome. Integrity leads to stability, and doing the right thing protects you. And when that breaks, it creates something deeper than disappointment. It creates disorientation. And so, because competence often outlasts coherence, people can still perform and they can still lead and they can still show up and look like you said, like on the outside, everything's going well. But internally, the alignment is gone. And most environments reward performance, not honesty. So the fracture stays hidden. So being honest and intentional about where you are, being vulnerable, and come on, the word vulnerability is such a taken as such like a bad word, because vulnerability, leads to harm. You put yourself out there and you can get hurt. Well, you can also never put yourself out there and never get help. So what's worse? Being isolated and lonely, out on an island by yourself, never experiencing the things that vulnerability tells you, ooh, you don't. Because no, at the end of the day, we enjoy love and encouragement and community and connection. Connection is so important for us. So the best advice that I think I've ever seen for someone who is isolated, lonely, out on that island, feeling like they're the only one, to get around other people. Be vulnerable enough to share your story. Open up to a trusted advisor, or that, 3 a.m. friend that you got. Because it encourages movement without integration when someone decides to take that pathway of reinventing themselves. And listen, to reinvent yourself can be harmful. I've lived it personally. There was a point when everything in me wanted to move forward quickly. New direction, new focus, new momentum. I wanted to get past, I didn't want to lay in the pain. I wanted to just go build a bridge right over that deep loss, because movement feels like control. But what I realized was movement didn't resolve anything. It just carried the fracture into a new space. So reinvention, it sounds powerful, but most of the time it's just movement that avoids what's actually needs to be faced. You got to face it. You got to face it. I know that for me, with my post-traumatic stress, there was seasons in my life, Lisa, where I felt like I carried a big stick. And every time it came around, I was just going to show it what, come on around here, you're going to get the big stick. I was pretty good at baseball. I get it both ways too. And so it was going to come around here and I'm just going to beat this away. And I realized some really powerful truths. Number one, trying to forget is worse than remembering. Because not only do you deal with the anxiety that you're remembering, you're dealing with the compounding anxiety that you can't forget, even though you're trying. And so the best thing to do is realize this is here in front of me. It's not going anywhere. I need to deal with it and just deal with it. Embrace it the best way that I know how, whether that's with great therapeutic help, trusted counselors, and all of that. And see where it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like when you're super anxious, people want to keep themselves busy so they don't have to feel that anxiety. But as soon as they stop, they feel the anxiety, and it's almost like a million times worse. Until you sit with it and face it, it's not going to go away.
And isolation, look, not all isolation is bad, but isolation is usually what happens when you get into that place where you feel like nobody understands me. Nobody's going to get this. I'm the only one going through this. And one of the great phenomena that I see in a lot of the group work we do around moral injury is when you have people who are sitting in the room, although they carry individual wounds, they realize, oh, other people walk through this. Other people experience isolation. Other people experience loneliness. And look, Loneliness is introspective. You can't look across the room and see who's lonely. Loneliness is the most dangerous risk factor of any risk factor that somebody could encounter. And loneliness accelerates everything because without someone who can sit with you in the ambiguity, your internal voice becomes the loudest one in the room. And over time, loneliness doesn't just make things harder. It distorts your internal voice until it's the only one you trust. That's where things begin to spiral. You can't stay in that place of loneliness too long because what happens is loneliness is what we call in the field a motivational phase factor. So again, when you think of pouring gas on a fire, right? That's, sometimes not the most smartest thing to do, but it's combustible. It explodes, right?
Right.
That's what loneliness does to suicidal ideation and behaviors. And look, I know that I reference suicide a lot, but that's my context. I'm a suicide prevention specialist in the VA working with veterans who are either have attempted to kill themselves or are seriously contemplating it. So I know that's an extreme example, but let's deal with the extreme example so we don't ever get there. Loneliness is something that is a fast track to suicidal ideation and behaviors. So if we can learn to deal with loneliness the way it needs to be dealt with, then not only are we not going to think things like, man, the world would be better off without me, but we're not going to act it out either.
So how do we even start? How do we reinvent ourselves? How do we face the loneliness? What do we do?
Well, reconstruction starts with honesty, not performance, not momentum, honesty about what did we lose. See, that's the loss is the common connector of all traumatic experiences. Doesn't matter what you went through, you lost something. And it's usually the loss that people struggle with, not the event. Not the combat situation, the sexual assault situation, the loss of a family member, the loss of a child, the loss of a job. And that's just to name a few across the gamut, right? It's the actual loss. What did you lose? What was violated? And probably most important, what still matters? And then slowly you begin to separate those. Who you were in the role from who you are at your core. That's the work right there. Who you were in the role and who you are at your core. That's where you begin. Not with answers, with accurate naming. Because if you can name what actually broke, you can rebuild that with integrity. But if you misname it, you'll keep trying to fix the wrong thing. I don't know. Have you ever had that situation in your life where this needs to be fixed, but you keep trying to fix this over here and you keep coming back to that? Well, there's a reason you do. You keep coming back to that because that's the most important thing to fix in the moment. It's what did you lose?
Most often, the thing that we avoid is the hardest thing to face. For me, I'll own that one. I often try and fix everything but the main core issue because it's the most difficult, the most challenging, the most emotional. The process is going to be the hardest to face. I think that's true for a lot of us.
Yes, it is 100%. And I can't not emphasize the importance of don't do it alone. You don't have to do this alone. Find a group, find a friend, find a community where you can walk together. As you walk it out, it's so important.
Yeah. So what does processing what was lost instead of bypassing it actually look like?
We use a word a lot, and people always confuse this word biblically. It's the word lament. And lament is, yes, found in the Bible, but it's also just a word. And it's the ability to take and put words to your suffering. It's why people instinctively a lot of times want to journal. They want to
Right.
just write it down because sometimes writing it down could be easier than actually vocalizing it. But once you write it down, then maybe you can share it verbally. Well, that's the part of communication. You have to be able to communicate how you're feeling and what was lost. Have you ever sat with people and you ask them how they're feeling and they tell you a random story?
Yep.
Yeah, it's because feelings are really difficult for a lot of people, and they don't even know how to assess what something feels like. So they usually instinctively tell a story because a story is distracting. I experience this a lot with veterans because, hey, let's just be honest about something. If you like what veterans do or what they did in their day job, then stories can be really, some can be cool, some can be heartbreaking. It's one of the reasons I think people are drawn to theater and movie. It's that movement of stories that are shared. But when you're trying to assess the root of what someone's suffering with, sometimes stories can be very distractive. Now, I'm not talking about narrative. I'm just talking about stories, right? So you ask them how they feel, you're looking for that narrative of maybe when their father told them they'd never amount to anything. And then they go into the service to try and show their father that they're going to amount to something. And then they get over into service and they end up having to kill a kid in combat. And now they really feel like they're never going to amount to anything. It wouldn't matter how many medals or decorations that they got in that combat situation. And maybe when they killed that kid had a bomb and they got an award for saving everybody else in their company because that kid was going to blow up. But that kid was 7 years old. And it doesn't matter how many awards, how many accolades, how many times someone would say, you did the right thing, that person killed a kid and that will never rest right with them. And there's nothing that you and I could sit across from them and say to justify that they killed a kid. So where do you go from there?
Yeah.
Because the reality is this, they're not a kid killer. They had to kill a kid in the moment. Because the end result would have been lost lives, maybe their own, those that were closest to them. So, can you live with that? Let's say you let the kid walk through it, blow up everybody else. Can you live with that? Well, the reality is you don't want to live with either one. But when people are placed in impossible situations, they have to search for an impossible way forward. And the only way forward to do that is with honesty, intentionality, and integrity. You just got to take the first step. And having a companion to walk with you is so important because most people in those situations, Lisa, they don't recognize themselves. They don't recognize themselves, right? And the fact that you don't recognize yourself doesn't mean you're lost. It just means something that once held your identity has changed, and that's disorienting. But it's not the end for you, right? Most people assume that feeling something, means something's wrong with them. But often it's just a sign that version of yourself that was once tied to that role or tied to that season and a structure that no longer exists for you. So don't rush to fix it. Don't rush to replace it. Slow down long enough to ask an honest question. This is the question. What actually changed and what still remains? Because if you can name what broke and you can identify what's still true about you underneath all of that, then you can begin to rebuild in a way that isn't dependent on something that can be taken from you again. And here's the thing. You're not starting over. You're learning how to stand without something you used to lean on. And that's where real identity begins.
Dr. Carter, how important is it who you surround yourself with? Because you often talk about environment and context. So how important is who you're around in this healing process?
I think it's so important, and it actually can define the whole process itself. I think we would agree that if you needed plumbing work at your home, you're not going to call an air conditioning tech, right?
Nope, quite
It's
simple.
not going to happen, right? And so you got to think about the mechanics of the injury as well. I'm not going to go to a brain surgeon for a heart surgery. So when you're dealing with complex things like trauma, loss, deep suffering, get with people who understand, not just from a theoretical academic lane, but from an experiential lane. And listen, I'm not saying that person has to have a doctor in front of their name like I do. That's not what I'm saying, because there are a lot of people who have degrees on the wall that aren't qualified to walk with people with what they're going through. They just have a degree, okay? Get with people who are trusted and timely companions that will walk with you where you need to go, not where they believe you should go, but where you need to go. Because this is the thing, it's your journey, not theirs. Grief is a wilderness. There is no map that anybody can hand you for what they've personally been through that will walk you through what you've personally been through. The reality is, you have to draw. Here's the real reality. You are drawing your map of recovery every day you move forward. It's your map. When you go into the wilderness, you can look at a place on a map and you can be like, okay, I want to go here. And you can start on your journey. But once you get there and you're actually walking that terrain, is the first time you realize what's physically around you, what's spiritually around you. And although I might have an idea of what could be along that path, until you walk it or I walk it with you, we don't know. We don't know. There might be a river that didn't show up on that map that now we have to cross. What if it's swift water? What if it's deep water? What if you can't swim? There's all these variables, right? So I think it's important that you go into the wilderness with someone that has a little bit of an understanding, or hopefully a lot of understanding, of what the wilderness is. In military context, we have SEER specialist, survival, escape, evasion, and rescue specialist, right? For every region. And before you go on a high quality mission into a specific area, that SEER specialist who's trained for that region will let you know what can kill you, what can sustain you, food, vegetables, berries, those types of things. What can kill you, snakes, spiders, animals, all of that type of stuff. Because when you get into the wilderness, you got to know how to survive.
So let's give the audience out there some hope. Maybe there's someone listening that feels completely disconnected. They don't recognize themselves anymore. What would you say to them? What would be some first steps forward?
Yeah. When you can't go back, the goal isn't to replace what was. It's to understand what remains and build from there. I know that sounds like this very, it's sometimes I feel like we're looking for these real long, exhaustive 12-step things to do. And here's what I can tell you. A lot of times when you've experienced specifically a moral injury that has shattered your concept of what would make you morally healthy, what has happened is your entire meaning-making system has been disrupted in a way that you don't trust systems, you don't trust people, you don't even trust yourself. So what you've got to do first is breathe. You got to breathe. You got to breathe and you got to center yourself, and you got to, after, box breathing is my go-to. Box breathing is very simple. If you think about a box, you inhale for 3 seconds, you hold it for 3 seconds, you exhale for 3 seconds, you hold that for 3 seconds. Maybe you can hold it longer, maybe you need it shorter. Whatever matters is not the length, it's the concentrated breathing. Do that 6 or 7 times in a row. And then find yourself a piece of paper and write down what still matters. Once you can write down what still matters, right? What you feel like has changed, what has still mattered, then from there, you can take some honest steps forward. Most people, I believe, run into cliche, something they've seen on social media. Not that everything you see on social media isn't bad, okay? But instead of finding something trusted and proven, they'll go for the quick fix, something that sounds just right to them. That's not always the best move to make because it's not a concentrated decision to focus on you. I think in those moments, after you breathe, after you get clarity, find a trusted advisor. Find something within yourselves or someone that you feel like you could go to. I call them 3 a.m. friends. They're great to have, right? Because you really know who your friends are when you call them at 3 a.m. and they answer the phone. And listen, if you don't have someone like that, there's a national crisis hotline. You dial 988. You go straight to someone, a counselor, or someone who is ready to talk to you. If you're a veteran, you can press 1 and it connects you directly to veteran-centric help around whatever you're dealing with. So if you don't have that go-to person, you can go right there. Okay. But there's something I call the shock of shame. Okay. Now I know that many of you that are watching or listening, you know that there is a physical shock that your body will take to absorb physical pain, whether you've broken a bone, been in a car accident, been shot or something like that. Your body will go into shock. And many times that shock is there to help you. It's there to help you loosen the pain enough where you could get to help. I mean, how else can you explain somebody who got shot in the chest running 2 miles in the jungle to get to a helicopter to get out? Okay. There's something supernatural taking over. Now, that type of shock, Lisa, is great for you. The shock of shame is not. The shock of shame comes, shame tries to tell you anything you do to better yourself, it's not worth it because you're not worth it. So don't do it. Best thing for you to do would just be go hang yourself, overdose, get wasted on something, go put a bullet in your mouth. Whatever that is, that shock of shame comes to do something. It comes to deaden your imagination to anything better. And so there's a question that I ask every high-risk veteran that I work with because it's the best way that I know how to just smack shame in the face and let shame know it's not controlling the situation. Because many times when shame is controlling the situation, it's also controlling the narrative. Okay. So on a I found it comes from motivational interviewing. It's called the importance ruler. So I say, look, on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being this isn't important at all, and 10 being it's the most important thing in the world, how important is it for you to live? And the average answer, now remember, I'm dealing with veterans who have been flagged high risk for suicide. So they've either attempted or they're seriously contemplating it to the point where all of their care teams have flagged them and they are on our radar. That's special attention, okay? That the number one answer is a 5 and the second is a 0. What happens with the shock of shame is if I were to ask you, on a scale of 0 to 10, and you told me you were a 5, and I went, how can I get you to a 10? Your imagination can't go to a 10. You can't contemplate that. You don't even feel, you barely feel like you're worth a 5. So trying to get you to think about what a 10 would be is impossible. Okay. But if I ask you to tell me why you're not a one and I shut up, well, now there's a differentiation. You're at a five. So you should be able to explain to me why you're not a one instead of a five. And whatever you share, whatever they share in that moment, this is the very thing that is keeping them alive. This is the very thing that is most important to them. Now, maybe they say, my pet, a promise I made to my daughter that I would walk her down the aisle. The thought of not being with my children as they grow up. Something my grandma told me back when I was a kid and we were picking beans. It doesn't matter what that is, but whatever they share in that moment, that is what is sustaining life. That is what is causing them to be resilient. That is the core of whatever is going to make them flourish as a human. So when you're writing that, when you get in that moment and you breathe, just make yourself a little 0 to 10 chart. On a scale of 0 to 10, how important is it for me to whatever that is? And then write a number and then go backwards. Tell me why you're not a one. Tell me why you're not a zero. Write that down because that's the place where you need to start. That's the place where you need to focus because that is what shame is trying to tell you you don't have access to. That's why we had to pull it from you. Okay. And once you do that, then one day at a time, not 10 days in one day, one day at a time. Do one thing, one positive reinforcement. Start building that number back up. By the time you get up to the place where you really feel like you're starting to get control of your imagination and shame is losing its narrative over your life, well, then a 10 is very accessible because everybody wants the 10 life. It's just how do we get there?
Yeah, thank you so much for being so open about this very important topic. I think it's really important to note also that we don't have to be anything. So I think humans, especially after a very strong identity, feel like they lose all of their worth when suddenly they don't have a title or something to identify by. But it's literally okay to just wake up in the morning and live and keep yourself alive if that's what you need to do, breathe and make a nourishing meal and just get to the next moment. Because that little bit of momentum builds and builds and builds and builds. But sometimes you just need those little steps to make it to the next moment. And that is okay. Society tells us that's not okay because what society is telling us is that we need to suck it up, get over it, push through it, move on to the next thing. It's life. What are you going to do? Kind of thing. But it does matter. And so we need to treat it like it matters and really pay attention to it and take it seriously. Tell everyone more about the work that you do and more about your book and where people can find more information, please.
Yeah. Well, you can find almost all information that you'd want to know about me. You can find it at drcarterchegg.com. I have a Amazon best-selling book called Healing in the Wild that was just translated into Arabic to help war-torn refugees that have been displaced all over the world, use nature as a way to deal with loss and suffering. And listen, when we're hurting, we need someone to show up. And I know I said it's important to have that 3 a.m. friend. And I know I shared the National Crisis Line number. But let me tell you what can show up when nothing else does. Nature. It's why I wrote Healing in the Wild. Because the wild does something most environments no longer do. It removes what is artificial and leaves you with what is real. And that's what you want. When you're hurting, you want someone to show up, whether you will agree with that or not. It's true. You want someone to show up. And in most settings, you can maintain an image and you can perform and you can produce and you can stay busy and many times avoid what's underneath. But the wild doesn't give you that option. It slows you down. It takes away the noise. It interrupts constant input. And in that quiet, that place by the beach, That place by the river, that sunrise, that sunset, that hillside that as you're taking in the stars, what's unresolved begins to surface, not all at once, but with honesty. Okay. And that's the reset. Not because nature fixes you, but because it creates conditions when you can no longer hide from yourself and you don't have to perform for anybody else. It also reorients you physically. Your body starts to regulate, your breathing changes, your nervous system begins to settle. And when the body settles, your thoughts become less reactive and less distorted. You can actually see more clearly. There's also something very grounding about being in an environment that isn't asking anything from you, right? There's no expectations in the wild. There's no roles to fulfill. There's the trees aren't asking you for pressure to be a certain version of yourself. It's just presence. I always say presence is the best medicine. And from that place, you can begin to separate who you are from what you're doing. That's where reset really happens. It's not a quick shift, but a return to something more stable, more honest, something that can hold you as you begin to rebuild. That's healing in the wild. So if you want to learn about healing in the wild, there's a lot of really cool practical steps in there for anybody who has experienced loss in their life. And I wrote it because, listen, not everybody will go into a clinical setting. Not everybody will enter into clinical spaces and offices. A lot of times they don't trust those spaces, but the wild you can trust.
Thank you so much for being here. What a powerful conversation.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure and honor to be here.
And to our audience, thank you so much for tuning in. So healing isn't about rushing to become someone new. It is about understanding what broke and then rebuilding from there what actually feels true to you. So again, Dr. Chuck, thank you so much for bringing such a beautiful language to something that so many people really don't know how to explain. If you want to know more about Dr. Carter Check and his work or his book, Healing in the Wild, all of his information will be in the show notes. And if this episode resonated with you or you think it will resonate with someone else, please send it to someone who quietly might be going through this so they can begin to heal and get the help that they deserve. Stay tuned for the next episode, everyone. Take care.